Well, it's a pleasure to be able to talk to you today. And I'm going to present to you some pretty new stuff from me, which you might not be able to guess, certainly not for any of my published work, although I've been saying things to people around here that made them suspicious because some sort of change in mind and all. And a lot of this is raw. It's all recent. Some of it is embarrassingly recent, like last week. I think this is a wonderful opportunity for me to test some of these ideas and find out what's wrong with them so I can go away and fix them, because I'm confident that there's a useful research project here, even if everything isn't straight right now. Okay, so in any case, if you don't have comments now, please come talk to me before the end of the week when I'll be leaving, because I would really like to get some feedback from this. Okay, secondly, there is one equation in this talk, and you won't like that. So this is very much a wordy talk, this philosophy talk, and not a physicist talk. I hope you will bear with me when you read a lot of words here, and I will be saying them also. So pay attention to that, and try not to go to sleep despite the temperature in the room and the lack of technical material. Okay. So, who said this? Pragmatic attitude, because of great success and immense continuing fruitfulness, must be held in high respect. Moreover, it seems to me, in the course of time, one may find that because of technical pragmatic progress, the problem of interpretation of quantum mechanics has been encircled. And the solution, invisible from the front, may be seen from the back.
Heidegger.
Nice try. in his essay, Six Possible Worlds of Quantum Mechanics. I was surprised to hear him say that because I think he's almost exactly what I think. I say almost exactly what I think. I've underlined five words and I'm going to change them a little bit and I'll tell you what I think. The pragmatist approach, not the pragmatic attitude. It was quantum theories, great success. And immense continuing fruitfulness, blah, blah, blah. One may find that because of philosophical pragmatist progress, not technical pragmatic progress. Okay. With those slight modifications, that's the view I'm going to try to sell to you. And the fact that that's so close to what Bell himself said, I think, is rather interesting. Okay. So here's the question. What is it to interpret quantum theory? Well, for a long time, I shared the view of many of my colleagues in philosophy of physics that the basic idea was to say what the world is like, quantum theory is true of it. That's to say, to rework quantum theory itself as a theory of what they'll call dualism. And a number of people have tried that. One popular approach is to take the quantum state as the vehicle. Einstein referred to this view while arguing against it as the orthodox view of the wave function. And I think that here I'm reading Weber, Perron, and probably Everett, although Everett's always been a slippery character, take that line also. And if you don't find your vehicles in the wave function or quantum state, then maybe you can look someplace else for them, or in ontic variables like in de Broglie-Bohm, or some variety of modal interpretation. But for all of that, the approach to try to understand quantum theory is to rework it as the theory of fields, the sort of thing that Bell wanted. Okay. Now, that's not it, it's to interpret quantum theory. This is my new view, okay? But what is it then, if that's not the game? To interpret quantum theory is to understand how and why that theory can be viewed as enormously successful. So this development was a highly progressive step in physics, even though it is not a theory of fields. So try and rework it so it becomes a theory of fields. Try to understand it as not a theory of fields, and try to see why it's such a wonderful theory, so understood. That's the idea. So if we can do this, then I think we can answer Bell's challenge. We'll go through that in detail, that's going to be most of my talk. We'll be able to show that quantum theory, as we have it, is perfectly satisfactory, even though it's not a theory of vehicles, it does not need to be reworked to become one. Now, we hope that progress in physics will continue by the development of success theories to the quantum theory we have. And on this, my view is completely neutral. When you guys or your esteemed colleagues come up with the latest and greatest breakthrough that displaces quantum theory and comes up with something better, that may or may not itself be a theory of evils. I take no stand on this. It's not for me to do that. I'm just interpreting the world. And Karl Marx said, the point is not to interpret the world, but to change it. That's your job. That's what this is. Okay. In any case, the success of quantum theory shows that any successors to quantum theory don't need to be theories of vehicles for their development to represent significant progress in physics. It might go that way, it might not. We don't know. We'll find out, I hope. Okay, so I'm going to spend a lot of time going through a number of Bell's charges against what he thinks of as the current sloppy formulation of quantum theory that we have needs to be replaced by a theory of vehicles, and maybe that's quantum theory itself. And I'm going to say a few words now about what's going on here. Bell is one of my great heroes. He's been an enormous influence on my thinking and the thinking of a lot of other philosophers of physics. I first heard about his work on non-locality in a talk by Rudolf Piles in the early 1970s. In the mid-1970s, Bernard Despande gave an early copy of the paper that became quantum theory for quantum mechanical cosmologists, and that had even more of an influence on me. So I've been sort of rooting for Bell for a very long time. And if you're going to do what I'm trying to do, then you really have a moral responsibility to address Bell's arguments, because they have been rightfully so influential. And that's what I'm going to try to do. Okay, so most of the discussion of Bell that I'm going to be focusing on can be found in his paper Against Measurement, but a considerable portion also comes from quantum theory, from mechanical cosmologists, and if you look through his collected works, you'll find similar things said in many other papers. Of course, I'm not going to be talking at all today, actually, about his work on non-locality. But rather his critical reaction to the current state of play in the foundations of quantum mechanics. Now, in the paper Against Measurement, he lays two charges against the word measurement. When I put single quotes around it, it's a word I'm talking about, not the thing the word refers to. And here's his first charge, I call the semantic charge. Everything in blue was said by Bell in one of these papers. The word comes loaded with meaning from everyday life, meaning which is entirely inappropriate in the quantum context. When it's said that something is, quote, measured, it is difficult not to think of the result as referring to some pre-existing property of the object in question. The word has had such a damaging effect on the discussion, Bell says, that I think it should now be banned altogether in quantum mechanics. So how can one respond to this? Well, I can point out that the word is still very much used in quantum mechanics, so not clear that he succeeded in his campaign to prescribe it, but maybe that's because we didn't take him seriously enough and we should have proscribed it. Here's a response to this. First of all, there's a threefold response. Quantum measurements of an observable are processes that would count classically as reviewed in a corresponding pre-existing property. Think about something like magnetic moment or component of spin or polarization. If classical physics were right, then passing things through polarizing filters would be a way of measuring polarization. So it's standard linguistic practice in science to preserve a term under scientific change. So consider a term like oxygen or electron. Oxygen is a particularly nice one. Was first used by, I guess, Lavoisier to describe the principle of bitterness. It wasn't an element at all in our current sense, and it had something intimately to do with acids. Today we don't think of oxygen that way. We haven't changed the name, we still call it oxygen. The electron has an even more interesting past, I won't go into that. So why not keep using the term? There's, as I say, standard linguistic practice in science to do that. Secondly, more importantly, quantum measurements can provide vital information. We'll later consider the question, information about what? So I'll just postpone that for a moment. And that's the essential function of any measurement. So why not call measurement what it is, a source of vital information. There's a third thing one could say, that I was tempted to say for a while. You could claim that what one measurement does is faithfully reveal something. It faithfully reveals upon a probability. How does it do that? It transfers it from an object to an apparatus. That's how something faithful is being revealed. It's the probability. But in the end, I'm going to reject that view because probabilities aren't properties. I'll tell you more later on about what I think probabilities are. Okay. So that was a semantic charge. I don't think that Felt himself thinks that's a very deep objection to the term measurement. The deeper objection is when he starts talking about the shifty split, which I'm sure you're all very familiar. The first, but I think most substantial charge against measurement that he raises in that paper is that in the fundamental axioms of quantum mechanics, it's the word measurement that anchors the shifty split of the world into system and apparatus. So most of the rest of the talk is going to be addressing this more substantial charge against use of the term measurement in a formulation of quantum mechanics. Okay. So what is this split? Well, quantum theory, probabilistic theory. In application of the theory, the Born rule generates probabilities for measurement outputs given a quantum state. And I write the Born rule that way for two reasons. First of all, I'm kind of old-fashioned, and that's how I got my mind around POBMs. But I think more substantially, on the left here, I want to be making it quite clear what's going on. We have a probability. This, the stuff on the right is just mathematics. The stuff on the left, we have a probability. We need to understand what a probability is. We have a quantum state. We need to say something about what that is. And we have something that is representing directly the measurement outcome. Dynamical variable A, Y is in Borel set delta. So the split is then between the system, which is assigned the state for all, and the apparatus, whose final condition is described as registering the outcome A is now one to delta. Okay. So that's the split. Why is it shifting? Well, any application of quantum mechanics presupposes a division into system and apparatus. But there aren't two kinds of objects in the world, the system and the apparatus, which I believe is the plural of apparatus. So the division can only be made in the context of a particular application of quantum mechanics. But there are different ways of applying quantum mechanics in a particular situation, corresponding to different ways of making that division. When you change from one to the other, you shift the split. When you shift it, but why is it shifting? Well, this is what Bell tells us. The problem is this. Quantum mechanics is fundamentally about observations. It necessarily divides the world into two parts, a part which is observed and a part which does the observed. The results depend in detail on just how this division is made, but no definite prescription for it is given. All that we have is a recipe, which, because of practical human limitations, is sufficiently unambiguous for practical purposes. That's the problem. How does it arise in more detail? Well, I think it arises in several different ways, but I'll give you a couple that I've found so far. We start by considering applying quantum theory to some physical object S. We do it by assigning S a quantum state, pro of S. The application gives probabilities of measurement outcomes of S. Great. But how do we measure S? We do it by an interaction with some object A. To represent this interaction in quantum theory, we must assign a quantum state to S plus A. And that'll give probabilities of measurement outcomes this time on A. That's what I was saying earlier about transferring probabilities. But we're not done yet, because how do we know how to measure A? Well, we bring up something else, B. And you can see what's happening. In the end, we are involved in what looks like an expanding chain. I won't say infinite chain. So one might wonder whether all these probabilities can agree. Well, certainly a model Hamiltonian will induce the right correlated final states for any sort of collective starting with S and throwing in more stuff. For an arbitrary initial state, rho of S, given the right initial states of A and B, and so on. So to that extent, there isn't a problem yet. And you might say there's no problem in principle. Of course, realizing such Hamiltonians in the laboratory might be different levels. Yeah. So why does Bell think the results depend in detail on just how this decision is made? So far, it seems like they don't. Well, because he thinks his measurement collapse is a physical process. That's why he thinks the result depends on how one makes the division. As you're probably all familiar, von Neumann used a model of the measurement to show that there'd be the same correspondence between the final quantum state of the system and an observer's experience of the measurement outcome, no matter whether the observer's observation collapsed the state of S, or S plus A, or S plus A plus B, or whatever. But of course, the quantum states of those various systems at intermediate stages will depend on the link at which the collapse occurs. So if you think a quantum state represents an object's intrinsic properties, different choices will yield incompatible accounts of how those change during the measurement process. Indeed, somebody might say, there's an empirical difference here. It's not just that if you get different quantum states, those different quantum states will yield different predictions, potential observations. The sun observer will use measurement outputs to discriminate among these quantum states. So it seems like there's something really at issue here. Bell himself, in the quantum mechanics for cosmologists, gives an example of this kind of situation, different ways of applying quantum mechanics. Many of you might be familiar. Example of other particle tracks. He gives two ways of trying to apply quantum mechanics to model systems to explain why you get a line when an alpha particle passes through a stack of plates, photographic plates. Well, first of all, the system is the alpha particle. Each plate induces a measurement collapse into an approximate position eigenstate. Plate is a measurement apparatus. You get a definite spot on the plate, and that serves to record the location of the collapse. And lo and behold, if you do the analysis and make a few approximations, the spots recorded in all these measurements very probably lie in a line. Good, but that's not the only way you have to do it. Suppose you treat the plates quantum mechanically as well. Then what happens? Well, now we take the quantum system to be the alpha particle plus a layer of axioms in every plate. The measurement on this system by further apparatus collapses it, just once, onto a state in which just one atom per plate is excited. The apparatus records its result as a list of all their positions, which very probably lie in the line. There are two different ways of applying quantum mechanics to the same situation. And the issue arises to whether or not the results are consistent. And what Bell himself says about this case is that if you make the right kinds of approximations, you can actually render them completely consistent. But then you read it and say, but are those approximations justified? After all, what about the interactions between atoms in different plates, for example? Wouldn't we need to throw them in to get at the meta story? And once we're starting to get meta stories, when do we stop? When is the true story going to emerge? That's sort of the idea. But let's start again. Well, that isn't physical. Quantum state doesn't represent an object's intrinsic properties. The collapse isn't a physical process, but represents advice updated on new information. So we thought we could make measurements, in principle, to discriminate where collapse occurred in the chain. But from this point of view, collapse isn't a physical process anyway, and so there's something misguided about that suggestion. And you can see that by saying, look, as a matter of fact, when somebody measured it, none of those measurements occurred. If they had, the measurement would have been unsuccessful. That licenses the observer in to choose just where to update this quantum state to suit its convenience. There's no substantial issue of where it really collapsed, because the collapse wasn't a physical process, but a decision by the observer to update his information. And the particular location at which he chooses to make that updating is unimportant. So no substantial issue arises here. Okay. But there might be another way the problem arises. Yeah.
Somehow I didn't understand the whole context of that last analysis that you did.
Okay.
I mean, there must be something implicit in it. Some operationalist context, some idea of a well-defined world of instruments. Or what? I mean, at some point, will you say something about
yes.
that?
Yes, I will. Probably not enough to satisfy you, but I'll say something. Okay. In fact, that's just the kind of challenge I want, because if I'm not satisfied when I'm done, then I want to work harder. Okay, here's another way the problem might arise. We started by considering applying quantum mechanics to some physical system, S, by assigning it a quantum state, progress. But why did we start there? After all, we all know about entanglement. Maybe that was a mistake. Maybe assigning a state to S ignores the chaotic nature of entanglement. If S is initially entangled with some other system, T, involved in a measurement on S, in some way, then they're joint state, maybe with different predictions than the state of rho S. So maybe we should have assigned S plus T in the state instead of just S. Well, at this point, you might say, look, that's easy to address that. There's an objection to what I just said, right? That can't happen. We can retrieve the state of S by tracing over the orbit space of T. And if we do that, then rho of S and rho of S plus T will yield identical properties, the measure of any observable in S alone. So really, there wasn't any problem introduced here, you might think. So here's a reply to that objection to try to reinstate the worry. In fact, the observable we're interested in measuring often concerns the relation between S and T, although we might not notice it at the time. And if that's the case, then tracing the state rho of S plus T over the Hilbert space of T will yield the wrong state for S. We don't want that. Here are a couple of examples, and don't challenge me on these, then I'll learn something. Measuring the position of an electron in a hydrogen atom. The first time you looked at hydrogen atoms, you probably assumed that the electron was sitting in the central force field. You forgot all about the central proton, except as a source of the central potential. And maybe you corrected for the physical existence of the proton by using the reduced mass of the electron rather than its own mass, but you didn't treat the proton as the quantum system. Well, maybe you should have done. Maybe you should have traced over the position of the proton and tried to figure out what to believe about the position of the electron. That would be a very bad idea. What you need to do is look at the relative position of the electron relative to the proton. Another example, I hope I got this right by now, I'm talking to you, if not, something I screwed up. Measuring the phase of the laser beam in thermodynamic protection. Here, there are two ways of applying quantum mechanics. Either you can take the quantum system to be a test beam of the laser light and represent it as coherent, and you take the measuring apparatus to be a reference beam plus detectors in homodimensional. And in that case, the intensities that these detect will record the phase of the test beam's coherent state. Well, you can do it that way. You can do it this way, too. You can take the quantum state to be both beams, not just the test beam, but also the reference beam. The apparatus now will be just the detectors, and they will record the relative phase between test and reference beams. Now, the results may depend in detail on how you make the division. It's true that the detector photon current will be the same, but only if the reference beam has an arbitrarily high amplitude, so that its mean photon number tends to infinity, will all correlations between the detector photon currents agree in the two divisions. Is that right? Yes?
Well, yes, strictly speaking, what you said, but
okay.
You could, in your first division where you yes. treat just the beam, single beam is quantum mechanical. You could add some decoherence to that to take into account a non-infinite number in your reference beam.
Thank you. I did know that, and thank you, Troy. Okay.
So just to clarify, does the analog in the other case is to assume that the nucleus has infinite mass or something like that?
It's
the nucleus in the other nucleus is well localized. Is that roughly?
I hand you over to Rob on that one. I hope so. You can answer that question later.
Yeah, okay.
That's okay. Okay. So, here's what Bell says, and this is sort of a bottom line remark, that's why it's in italics. The following rule for placing the Heisenberg split, which is what we've been talking about, although we call it one line on chain, but maybe that'll make you the wrong conclusions to use talking about this. The following rule for placing the Heisenberg split, although ambiguous in principle, is sufficiently unambiguous for practical purposes. Put sufficiently much into the quantum system that the inclusion of more would not significantly alter practical prediction. And this Bell thinks is the best you can do, and it's not good enough. That's sort of the bottom line of his critique. For all practical purposes, it's not good enough. Why not? Well, let's see. In classical mechanics, we have a model of a theory which is not intrinsically inexact, for it neither needs nor is embarrassed by an observer. At least one can envisage an accurate theory of the universe, to which the restricted account is an approximation. Quantum theory is fundamentally approximate. Or maybe I should stress that differently. Quantum theory is fundamentally approximate. Quantum mechanics is intrinsically inexact. So these are the kinds of things that are wrong with quantum mechanics, even though it's fine for all practical purposes. So these are the kinds of challenges that need to be addressed. So here we go. Every application of every theory is for all practical purposes. That's true for classical physics just as much as it is for quantum theory. To apply either theory, one must consider some physical system and either ignore the rest of the world or model its effect on this system in a highly simplified way. In both theories, including more in the system may lead to a more reliable model, but it costs a greater complexity. Think about applying Newtonian mechanics and gravitational theory to the solar system. Well, you model it by saying you have this central sun with infinite mass, and you have a few planets, Newton's day, negative six, and that's about all. And the only thing that, of course, in action is gravity. And, well, that's our first shot at modeling. But then we have more complexity. We look at the existence of moons. We look at the perturbations that Jupiter provides in the orbit of Mars and so on. And then we have a better model. But there's no point at which we stop and actually get the right application, in the sense that we can't actually set right down or even hold in our heads the right application of Newtonian mechanics to the solar system. So what's the difference? Well, there is still a difference, and this is what really bugs Clark. It's getting back to his remark about envisaging. Only in classical physics can one envisage a model representing the whole universe. In all its details, if the theory were true, this model could be perfectly accurate. Nothing in the model need be designated as perfect. Although it might be that some parts of the model might be supposed to represent observable physical systems. So the observer wouldn't appear essentially in the model, but you could add it as color, as it were, on top of the model. And then if you had this ideal classical physics picture that Bell is envisaging, well, things that we can envisage, actually, be more careful here. I don't think he is envisaging it, because I'll try and argue with nobody putting it. But he thinks we can envisage it. Simplification of that model might, in principle, be arrived at by controlled approximations. So that might be some satisfying. Okay. And this is supposed to be a difference between classical physics and quantum. So I want to ask this question. This is a new argument, and I hope you will leap up and challenge it, because I'm not sure it's right. I'm going to try it anyway. Could there be a model? Could we envisage a model which is perfectly accurate and represents the universe in classical physics? Bell thinks, yeah, of course we can. First of all, the model would exceed human cognitive limitations. Nobody could actually have that model in their head, in their computer, on paper. It just can't be done. And even if we all tried with all of our supercomputers and all of our paper, it wouldn't be done. It's too much. Secondly, things get more interesting. Suppose the scientist wanted to represent himself in the model in full detail. What would that mean? I mean, he's treating himself as a physical system. But one would think that as a scientist, he's interested in doing that because he wants to predict what's going to happen next or to explain something in the world. But can a scientist simultaneously treat himself as a physical system and predict his behavior and also decide what to do? This is close to the problem of free will, but it's a little different. And I think that situation to exclude the possibility of anybody actually representing himself in such a model and using it to do anything that scientists want to use models to do. Now, here's an important point. Only in use can anything represent anything. A model just sitting there as mathematics or marks on paper doesn't represent anything. then becomes to represent something if someone uses it to do something. Now, I've just tried to argue that nobody could use the model that Bell envisages to do anything, in which case it doesn't represent anything. No one could use it, so it couldn't represent the universe after all.
What do you mean by using use over and over?
Yes. Well,
useless.
Right, right. What sort of things does one use a model to do in science? To predict things, to explain things, to understand the world. None of those things could be done with this. That's the idea.
So can you explain that in the second point?
Yes.
Why we use the safer understanding the world?
Okay. I think that's going to be a point I'm going to leave to the end, because that's the hardest question. Thank you for asking. Okay. I'm not sure I've got a good answer to that question yet, but it's one I need to bear in mind. Basically, because I don't have a well-developed account of explanation, and one would require a well-developed account of explanation to establish any conclusion about what whether something could lead to the kind of understanding and explanation would provide.
I see, like, in the meaning of like using it to do calculations, I see the same.
Okay. It's a good worry. And this is one of the things that worries me about this argument. It might just collapse. So it's good to put pressure on it. Anyway, if we've got this far successfully, which is in doubt, we can arrive at a contradiction. In which case, one cannot envisage a model representing the whole universe before itself. So what Bell just gave is assumed is false. So if you can't do that in classical physics, what's the big deal? You can't do that in quantum.
When you say that it represents the universe in full detail,
yes,
that would exceed human cognitive limitation.
Yes.
Does that mean that to actually give every detail would exceed our limitations?
Yes.
Or does it, but couldn't we still understand the essence of the model, you know? Like, we write down some field equations. We think we understand, essentially, what kind of things the model is telling us and so on. And then you make, like you said, some approximations.
You can ideal
gas or something like
you
that.
You can idealize the universe in the way that you can idealize the solar system. And you might think that your idealizations are better than his, because they include more stuff and they're working from better theories. But you're still going to leave a lot out. Now, the point is that if you're allowed to idealize stuff, then quantum mechanics can do that.
Well, I don't understand why. Suppose it tells you this is what the constituents of the universe are,
mm-hmm.
how they interact and everything, whatever, what we take normally to describe as theory. But it doesn't tell you every detail of the initial conditions, or something like that. Why is that not sufficient for the kind of thing that those things you approximate?
You said these are the constituents of the universe. Now, did you mean that we had an actual list of all of the things in the universe, that we had a general description of the kinds of things that the universe consists of?
Say the second one.
Then we don't have the complete accurate model here. We just have a much less.
But you have some bounds. You have some bounds. Yeah, these are the approximations.
But Bell's point is that to make sense of approximation, you have to have something from which you're approximating. So we need to have the full, accurate, exact model, and then we can start about approximation. If that were not his point, then we could apply that the same reasoning to quantum theory.
I mean, that can be a parameter of the model, just in the same way that the initial conditions are a parameter.
Okay. Can we resume this later? Because I am worried about this argument, and this is, again, more pressure of the time that I want to get. Thank you. It's not
like
the whole paper depends on it.
Why isn't there like a Robert's Law for universe model of the whole universe, which doesn't exceed our human cognitive limitations?
Well, we can make models of other universes like that, but it's not a model of our universe if you want to get it right. And Bell's talking about accuracy and exactness, and that's not exact or accurate.
Oh, okay, so it's a contingent fact about our universe that we can't model, but in general, there's no reason you couldn't model a fairly simple universe.
Well, could you be in a simple universe to do the modeling?
Uh-huh.
I would say no. Again, it's a question of use by us, or if not us, by somebody who counts as a scientist. But that's all there are theories and models for anyway.
Mm-hmm.
That's the perspective. I'm trying to push you toward that perspective, but I expect a lot of resistance. And thank you for providing me. Okay. So now I'm going to go through a list of rhetorical questions to which, I mean, Bell's poking fun at the view that I want to develop. And so he asks a bunch of provocative questions, supposing that nobody could possibly answer them. So let's take them seriously, see if we can answer them. What exactly qualifies some physical systems to play the role of measure? Well, measures are not physical devices with special dynamical powers able to collapse huge wedge functions with a single glance. One must distinguish the role of agent from that of instrument. What's a measure? It's an agent with an instrument. In the limiting case, the instrument is part of the agent's own right. To apply quantum theory, an agent, and all agents must be physically in the world, we're not talking about blood or anything like that, must be able to describe some instrument classically in its role in recording outcomes. Now, this word classically, I'm putting in scare quotes. I will say something later on about what I think that means. So don't jump on me right now, okay? But I do expect to be jumped on later. So that's an answer to Bell's first question. How long did the wave function of the world have to wait before jumping? Another reductio ad absurdum question. Well, the world doesn't have a wave function. Only agents have wave functions. An agent may assign a wave function to a system at a time arbitrarily past the present or future at the moment when he assigns it. The system may be a simplified model of the world, excluding the agent, but it might be a model of something else. Jumps are updates of an agent's wave function for a system, not dynamical events, but to repeat what I said before. Are we going to be obliged to admit that more or less measurement-like processes are going on more or less all the time, more or less everywhere? This is more or less true. But the suitable physical interaction between one object and another object, if it's like an agent, could have used as an instrument to perform its quantum measurement on it, if only been there at the time. Do we not have jumping then all the time? No. Even though suitable interaction between an object and instrument type object are going on all the time, at least these days, in the early universe, maybe not, they're not accompanied by jumps in any wave function. The wave function jumps only at the behest of an agent whose wave function it is. No feasible agent is able to represent each of these objects by a wave function, even if he could. He could not update this depending on the determined subsequent condition of every instrument type object with which it suitably interacts. If you think I'm being too subjective talking about the agent, then, you know, in many circumstances, the agent could be the entire scientific community today. For many purposes, that would be perfectly fine, because there'd be many purposes. It would often be the case that the entire scientific community, in my view, is sort of targeting the same wave function, say, for the early universe or something. So there's nothing nothing about the individual human agent that was important to me. Information about what? Two answers to this question. Okay. First answer, actual or hypothetical future measurement outcomes. That's what we're talking about. But, of course, actual or future, or hypothetical future measurement outcomes could be very interesting. It could be used by us to encode all kinds of more useful information. In which case, the answer would be anything you like. In quantum computer, these measurement outcomes may include useful information, for example, about the prime factors or products of two prime numbers. That'd be fine too. So there's a direct answer, information about actual hypothetical measurement outcomes. But given the significance that we can endow these with, it's entirely up to us what information we extract from that information. That's where quantum computation comes along. Information for who? This one's a bit tricky. Information for any agent in the same physically specified epistemic situation. This physical specification is not described quantum mechanically, but classically. Again, that kind of weasel word that we have to talk about. Often, though not always, we all count as being in the same epistemic situations. So the answer is information for us. There's actually a point about time here, right? Information for us now might be different from information for us yesterday, or before we did that measurement, or something like that. So when I say information for us, that's actually tensed in this sense. Because our epistemic situation changes all the time as we learn more, forget things to learn. Okay, so that's an attempt to answer those rhetorical questions. And I was taking them seriously rather than just taking the jokes to be brushed aside. Yeah, of course, nobody would fuss about that one. If you don't take Bell's view seriously, then you'd be stuck with all these really embarrassing questions. Okay, so now let's move on. We'll leave Bell behind a little bit. And I'm going to try to show where I'm trying to get. Yeah,
can I just
say yes.
I'm thinking of cosmology, but sometimes we make a statement about what happened in the early universe.
Right.
We're really supposed to interpret that as nothing more than a prediction about the results of future measurements that we might make?
I don't think so, but I haven't got a better way of putting it yet. Here's my problem. I'm going to say pretty soon that quantum mechanics itself doesn't describe anything. So the descriptive content has to come from elsewhere. And where? Well, measurement outcomes. But then that's the direct descriptive content. What I have not yet worked out is how we can somehow leverage the direct descriptive content into something less direct, so that we are entitled to make statements about the early universe. Okay? But they're not going to be statements that follow from any wave function in any direct way. That's important. That's tricky. Again, that's another excellent question, but I haven't got a good answer to yet. But I'm working on it. I told you this was wrong. Okay. So, this is important. The quantum state is a rich repository of reliable advice for a situated agent wishing to form opinions on classically described matters for which he's in. That's what it is. Okay. It offers a prescription. Another description. And agents in different situations might be well advised to look to different quantum states. For example, in situations when Alice has performed a measurement and Bob doesn't know what the result is, or maybe doesn't even know what she's measured yet, then they might see different quantum states because they're in different physically specified situations. There's no true quantum state that collapses when Alice does something. That's a mistaken perspective on things. So all agents are situated on this thing, and the situation of one agent may differ from the situation of another agent. And most obviously, your situation after you perform the quantum measurement is quite different from your situation before you. So obviously, you don't want to take the same quantum state you did before. Okay. So the role of the quantum state is to generate probabilities of measurement outcomes in particular situations. That's what it's for. Direct. Now, here's something that's going to take a while to explain. What are these probabilities? They're not subjective. But neither are they frequencies or chances. So what are they? Well, let's see. Their role. When you look at the Bohr rule, it spits out a number for probability. The role of that number is as an instruction or a recommendation to an agent to adjust his degrees of belief to that number. That's what's going on. So the Bohr probabilities are prescriptive. They say, if you take this quantum theory stuff seriously, and you believe what physicists tell you about what the quantum state is, then this is what you should believe, or this is the degree to which you should believe something. Now, if you think about what I just said, the question, what are probabilities, sort of disappears. They're nothing in the world. They aren't chances, they aren't frequencies. And they're nothing in the agent either. They aren't states of mind. Their role is not to describe anything. But rather to prescribe something. The Bohr rule uses prescriptions, not descriptions. quantum probabilism skills neither describe nor represent anything in the world or in any agent. This is something that I don't think anybody in this room would like very much. That's the view that I wish to put before.
You'd like it.
No, not really.
No.
Well, we've been talking about this for 2 weeks.
Right.
I still put my probabilities on the inside of the agent.
Right. You can have that too.
And Richard wants them to be floating out there, and every now and then an agent gobbles one up and uses them.
Almost, but you see, they're not floating anyway. They don't exist. They don't have the form or descriptions of something that may or may not exist.
Floating at some level, not in the physical world, but maybe in some kind of platonic world, almost.
Let me just go on, because I think I want to reject that. Certainly platonic world stuff. I still think nothing for your probabilities as attempts to say what's true in some world or other. But that's the wrong way to think about things. Okay, so what are these measurement outcomes? Well, of course, Bell was really skeptical about what he said he made of that, and he wanted some increase in precision by concentrating on the variables, which can be described in classical setting, because they are there. The variables must include the settings and switches and knobs on experimental equipment, the currents and coils and readings of instruments. And of course, famously, he was attracted to reworking quantum mechanics so that it includes a lot more stuff going on at the micro level. Such that given that stuff going on at the micro level, then we can see why there all the settings and switches and knobs on the experimental equipment have to be there. That was sort of the program. Okay. So here's the question. Are measurement outcomes beautiful? Well, take it for granted that they are. But wait a minute. Can we say instrument readings are there? Now classical physics will be undercut by quantum. That's not so clear. Certainly useful to do so. It's useful in everyday life, and in continuing to apply classical physics, which we do all the time, when quantum effects are irrelevant. So it's a good idea to pretend that your instruments are there when you're designing them, because otherwise it will be hard to get around and where people's coming to the lab. But more importantly, in the present context, one must say that such things are there in order to apply quantum theory at all. Without classical descriptions and measurement outcomes, quantum theory would be useless, as it could offer no advice on what to believe in this field. Any application of quantum theory requires the use of descriptive terminology that theory does not provide. That's the essential point. And that's why we keep talking about classical descriptions in quantum theory. The word classical is really unfortunate, okay? Because I'm going to argue that all description is classical. And therefore, we don't have to worry about whether we can still use this outmoded theory to describe stuff. Okay, but I'll go on to that in a moment. So I have a new phrase. Measurement outcomes are not variables. They're receivables. Okay. Well, what does that mean? Well, the success of quantum theory shows that one can say instrument readings are there in some contexts. Since measurement outcomes can be assumed, I propose to call them receivables. But one can describe contexts in which it would be important to treat a measuring instrument quantum mechanically, not to describe it classically. Notice I didn't say to describe it quantum mechanically, I said to treat it quantum mechanically. Because again, on this view, quantum mechanics itself doesn't describe anything, but you can still use it to treat things. Okay. Again, that's coming back to what I just said, all description on this view is classical. Since quantum theory adds no descriptive terminology of itself. In particular, quantum state doesn't describe the system to which it's assigned. Quantum rule probabilities don't describe physical systems. They don't describe frequencies or outcomes. They don't describe agents' beliefs. They don't describe anything. Classical doesn't mean using only terminology for classical physics. It certainly doesn't mean really buying into classical physics and applying Newton's laws to the instrument or anything like that. And even if you throw in supplemental by language from daily life, that still doesn't exhaust the content of the classical the way I'm using it. In particular, the terminology of any non-quantum science, new or old, counts as classical. So we can, science can go on with all kinds of new terminology, and that's great, and that'll add to our repertoire of classical description, or what I'm calling classical description.
Wait a minute, that's too broad, isn't it? I was with you up till, I mean, okay. I think if you probably met, you know, Galilean, Aristotelian, Newtonian.
No, new stuff.
These are all
classical.
Because there's maybe just a space-time description or something, and I thought you were going to fill that in. But no. Why would anything,
well,
any, what,
in perspective.
What makes something non-quantum? Maybe that's a way to sort of flush this out.
Well, since all that's quantum is either a quantum state description or a probability that falls from quantum state description, everything else is classical. That's not quite true. We want to be able to talk about fermions, for example. To talk about something being a fermion is to say something about a restriction on quantum state assignments to things. Again, that's not quite descriptive anymore, because you're saying, when applying quantum mechanics to these kinds of things, only use these kinds of quantum states. So there's another prescription rather than description, I think. But I haven't quite sorted that stuff out yet. Because, as I said in response to Raphael, I do want to extend the descriptive language in a kind of tentative way. So perhaps what I'm saying now, all straightforward description is classical. First-order description is classical. We might be able to commit ourselves slightly less well-founded descriptive usages in the light of quantum mechanics. And I'll say maybe a little bit about that in a minute.
Is this a version of what you're saying? There is prescriptive and there is descriptive.
Yes.
And everything that is prescriptive, Richard Healy will call quantum. And everything that is descriptive, I'll call it classical.
Get out!
That's not it. That's not it.
No.
Okay.
Right. So, it's rather everything that's quantum is prescriptive. But that way around. But not the other way around.
But not the other way around.
Right. Sorry, I didn't mean to talk. Just being straight.
But do we have a sense of what quantum means? And it's another one of our points of discussion. I would call quantum everything that is captured by the formalism. You want to call what is quantum, what is captured by the formalism, plus some experimental practice that can only be observed in various laboratories around the world, and you don't know quite how to define that yet.
Right, right. Yeah, this is going to be a point that we'll have to talk more about. But you're right. I take it
so it's formalism plus something more.
There are prescriptions, I think, as to how one should assign quantum states, as well as prescriptions for how to adjust one's degrees of belief in the light of the numbers that the formula throws out once you assign quantum states. And those prescriptions are something that's input to quantum mechanics. You could think of them as like initial conditions. We used to think of initial conditions as descriptive. These are prescriptive. I think that's the view, as far as it exists. This is really tentative stuff. So please keep objecting, that I can collect all the objections.
So maybe what it's because you obviously you just say you don't need description in the body sense. Describe broadly your concept of numbers. But do you mean like data? So things that data might be associated with a person.
I want to go beyond that, because data suggests accessible to us here and now.
Oh, so you see how so you do have an ontological notion of
No, not quite. I'll say more about that later. That's where the Bredinism comes in, because you want to back off from ontology.
Right.
Is it true?
Right.
And here's where we come in, right? So, what I said there is all description is classical. Now, I'm already wavering a bit on that in response to what Raphael was saying, and I think I have words to do there. But in any case, all descriptions have their limitations. And in particular, accepting quantum theory means limiting the inferences one's prepared to make based on what I've been calling classical descriptions. You certainly describe contexts in which you've been calling to treat any macroscopic object, not just measuring instruments, quantum mechanically, not to describe it classically. For example, with the interior universe being his friend. You better not describe him classically, because otherwise you'll get in trouble. You better treat him quantum mechanically, at least in understanding what you predict about what will happen when you perform various subtle measurements like the interior universe in him.
Wait, how can you say you'll get in trouble if you haven't said what the classical description is?
Well, I mean, okay.
So,
that's a good question. Let's see. If you think that by saying, as big as outside the room, well, the measurement's all over now, so this is every result, it follows from that that it's impossible to reverse the evolution that produced that militarily, then that would be bad. That's a fallacious inference on this. So that's the kind of inference one can't make. But it's still okay, provided one isn't going to make that inference, to say that there is a definite result. It's just that these descriptions don't have quite the power you might have thought they had. You can't make the sorts of inferences from them that you were used to being able to make. That's the idea. I mean, just to take a trivial example, if I told you this table is flat, then you know, you might infer that if you put a full glass of water on it, it wouldn't spill. But you wouldn't infer from that that if I had a really subtle measuring device, it would prove to be a perfect Euclidean plane, right? So that kind of inference that would not be an appropriate inference to draw from that description. And all descriptions are like that, think about it. They all have a kind of inferential content. And what quantum mechanics is telling us is that when we describe an instrument as being, there being a definite outcome, we have to back off a little bit from the kind of inference we used to make when we describe them. That's so this is part of the pragmatism. This is supposed to be pragmatism, so why is this pragmatist? Well, the pragmatist asks, what's this good for? Quantum states and probabilities are good for guiding beliefs, and therefore action. They achieve this without describing anything. Classical descriptions of macroscopic objects are good for applying quantum theory, as well as for many more mundane purposes. But for certain more esoteric purposes, they are not good. Are they true? You already answered that question. That was the answer. Okay, so what's still to be done? In the beginning, says Bell, natural philosophers tried to understand the world around them. Experimental science was born, but experiment is a tool. The aim remains to understand the world. This is getting to your point. To restrict quantum mechanics to exclusively about fiddling laboratory operations is to betray the great enterprise. Wanted, a pragmatist to counter explanation. Capable of showing how quantum theory can be applied to explain natural phenomena in and outside of the laboratory. Since quantum theory adds no descriptive resources of its own, this will be an account of how a theory may be used to explain a phenomenon without itself describing it. Now, like a week ago, I thought the only way to go here was to say, oh, what we've been saying as philosophers about explanation was all wrong. Explanation is not description plus something. We can get explanation without description at all. But I think in response to the sorts of concerns that Raphael was raising, that can't be quite right. We need to be able to describe something, however tentative, in order to get an explanation. But that's where the sort of the notion of indirect description is going to have to come. Somehow we use quantum mechanics to license certain tentative descriptive usages. And those are the ones that we're going to try to parlay into explanations. So when we want to explain the formation of structure in the universe, for example, we're going to have to somehow parlay our quantum mechanical our quantum mechanical usages into something which counts as, in some weak sense, descriptive. Not in a full-blooded sense in which you can describe the outcome of a measurement by saying Geiger counter click, but still a very tentative sort of light notion of description. That's it. Yes.
Thank you, that's a win.
Well, thank you, Richard. There's a lot in that talk. And maybe some of it's right.
Yeah, some of it is right. In fact, it seems, it almost seems to me that there's two talks there.
Yes.
There's replying to Bell,
right,
and there's the defending of a scientist account of the Founders Academy of Quantum Mechanics.
Yes. I take it in the second is ultimately necessary to really see the first.
Yeah, well, I would put it a little differently. If you take the second group, then you don't have to reply to Bell, because Bell, you didn't quote, I don't think this was exactly in one of the posts, but what one of the things Bell says is that words like measurement and observer and apparatus don't belong in any fundamental physical theory. And a lot of what he is, those things you're quoting was directed at is someone who does take quantum mechanics as a acceptable fundamental physical theory.
Mm-hmm.
And your line is that you don't want to take it as a physical theory at all in the sense that Bell wants it.
No, but it's still a great physical theory in another sense.
Right, but yeah, right, but a physical theory in another sense. Not a physical theory that describes the world, but a physical theory that gives you prescriptions for how to deal with the world, which we have learned to, is a good, are good prescriptions for dealing with the world.
We're dealing with the world, in the end, is going to have to be a lot, not just successfully
right.
predicting outcomes of
right.
devotion experiments.
Yeah. And it, but it still seems to me that even if you succeed in the pragmatic mechanics for quantum mechanics and getting all the worries worth, it still leaves open something. And this is you're suggesting in the last slide, something which I think was behind the enterprise of interpreting quantum mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like that phrase either. The way I introduce it when I teach my philosophy of quantum mechanics classes, I start out saying, the question I'm interested in is, what does the success of quantum mechanics tell us about the world we live in?
Mm-hmm.
And one way you could put that is, what kind of world is it such that these prescriptions are good prescriptions for dealing with it? And I think that we still want to have an answer. So we still want to have a description of the world, whether something like a quantum state is a part of that description or not. We want that description of the world, and one of the clues we have as to what the right description is that the quantum probabilities are good ones for dealing with it.
I think that most of us do want that. What I'm suggesting is we can do great science and just not want that.
Oh yeah, we don't have to want that.
But it's wrong to think that is the goal of science. That is a goal, which sometimes science seems to be going towards.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be.
Yes, but it's certainly not the only possible goal. So
right.
There's lots of reasons for doing science.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's not like you're sacrificing something really vital in the way that Bell thinks it is. You don't pursue that goal. You're sacrificing an old way of doing science. But science has changed a lot over the centuries. The Cartesian spoke Newton was terrible because he introduced these occult forces and things. People got over it. So it's possible that we could come to think that that was just a way of doing science that we've now realized is, for present purposes, not the best way of doing science.
Yeah, it's kind of related. Maybe the question's been destroyed now. So I was going to ask, would you say, that people's different, lots of people have different sort of requirements of what they want from some kind of interpretation or explanation of quantum mechanics?
Yeah.
Would you say that, people's different, what different people require really boils down to what they think of as an explanation, what they think of as a sufficient kind of explanation? For instance, if you really want some kind of causal explanation to everything, deterministic and Millesian causal explanation, you want to be a Bohmian because you can see that everything that happens at time t is something else. I mean, you were sort of looking for, hoping towards some sort of different kind of something different that would satisfy you as an explanation. So do you think really that those differences in opinions that are most of the time quite implicit between different people just boil down to what they really mean by an explanation?
I think there's a bit deeper than that. I mean, I think that the desire to reinstate causal explanation within science is one that is not necessarily fruitful. It doesn't seem required to deliver what's important in scientific progress, and at least in this context. So that might be just hankering after a way of doing things that seemed to work quite well, but it's not now that something that one should necessarily take as a bottom line or even be distracted too much by when seeking more important goals.
If it's not causal, what kind of, what generally, what would be the form of this form of explanation which doesn't have any kind of causal?
That's an excellent question, but I think that to talk about something being causal is a pretty, if you try to analyze what you mean when you say such things, it's sort of a morass. So it might be a good idea in the end to give up on the whole idea of causal explanation rather than to try to understand what it is and then implement it. But you look up, I mean, you can't just give up and come over nothing by way of substitute. So that's, I think, an important challenge for somebody taking my line. I definitely do not want to be thought of as an instrumentalist. Like, an instrumentalist is somebody who thinks, oh, all that matters is predicting and measuring the outcomes. That's not right. Explanation, understanding, that matters too. So I need a story of that, but it's not going to be causal.
I mean, well, two things. I think there's a difference between trying to explain quantum mechanics and trying to explain natural phenomena. When it's explaining quantum mechanics, it's like a pedal level thing. So I think it's, in some sense, that's what a Bohmian is trying to do.
I'm not sure. I mean, some Bohmians seem to want to go beyond quantum mechanics and show why.
Okay. That made more sense. Two different questions. But I was going to ask, why isn't, maybe naive, but why isn't something like a deductive nomological model of explanation the sort of explanation that pragmatists would accept? I have some rules and I have some inputs which are the results of my preparations, and then I make predictions, and if I can make successful predictions, then I can explain.
Two things. The deductive nomological model of explanation is inadequate for various reasons. At least have to be pumped up by something extra. And I've already rejected pumping up the causes. I'm more sympathetic to attempt to introduce unifying power or something on top of the DNA explanations. But in any case, from this point of view, I want to back off on description. It's essential to the DNA account that you can describe the exponents and show why that description, those sentences which describe something, imply the exponent.
I don't see that. The way I was thinking about it, it was just more like the way hypothesis would think about DNA exploration.
Right.
So I just have some inputs. It's a matter of I have a successful explanation if I'm assuming my observations as some sort of regular, I find some regularity in the data.
Okay. Now, some of us have problems because, you know, why take logic so seriously if all that stuff that's dealing with unobservables is actually just verbiage and not descriptive. So there are a lot of things that steer me away from the chance of explanation.
Okay. I just thought it was sort of friendly to the approach you're adopting here. It's more minimalist and less metaphysical.
In those respects, yes.
Okay.
In other respects, it's not buying deeply enough into the practices. But, you know, you could say, well, we'll come back and tell us anybody we can, otherwise, just shut up. It's a reasonable point. Yes?
Yeah, I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more about what a pragmatic account of explanation is. And in particular, do you think that the success of the Horn rule as a prescriptive rule is something that itself calls for explanation? Or is it just a brute fact? I mean, that sounds too instrumental, right?
I think that the success of the Horn rule must depend on certain regularities that it's hooking into it at some level.
And those are in the world.
Yes.
So can we describe those?
Yeah, some of them anyway. Probably. We just did that. Because a lot of those regularity do concern machine learning. And we can describe them. That's okay. So, I do want to say that, and this is very important, it hasn't already been obvious. The reason we take quantum mechanics seriously in the first place is because it takes great success in predicting frequencies of measurement outcomes. So that is definitely something that's been taken very seriously. And that, in some sense, is why the Coulomb rule is a good prescription. I think this might be going far afield. It's rather like weather forecasting. The probability of rain tomorrow is 90%. Well, you know, you think he's actually basing that on some pattern of regularity in the world at some level, and so you take your umbrella. So that's a good prescription.
This was somewhat along the same lines as the last question about the meaning of pragmatism.
Yes.
Actually, I'm not really thoroughly acquainted at all. Writing, would you say that it's in some sense putting human beings at the center of the universe?
Not quite. It's putting situated agents.
Do you know of any other situated agent?
But my dog's not much of a scientist,
so I admit.
I think that's important. Pragmatism is about situated agents. It's not about, Plussian demons or God or anything like that. And the reason why that's true is because we're ultimately trying to understand scientific theory, and the scientific theory is something that we create. And we're agents. So it's not surprising we end up coming back to agents in understanding scientific theory.
But what's disturbing to some people is that, that quote you had from Mel seems to me like exactly the right quote. It's abandoning the original enterprise of science, which was, yes, as human beings, to understand the world as a whole, understand as much of it as we can. And this is something anthropic, it's like the anthropic principle. You're putting as a fundamental principle that there should be these agents and so on. You would never be able, for example, to explain why we can't interexist. Why are there human beings?
No, that's not true. I mean, the way that quantum mechanics is going to get applied is to any system that you want to apply it to. Now, that won't include you, who are going to be applying, but I can apply quantum mechanics to you, treating you as a physical system if I want to, at least in principle. Of course, it's crazy.
But we take the whole community of science and human beings.
Any individual scientist can apply quantum mechanics to all of the other scientists.
Yeah,
in principle.
But the whole community cannot apply it according to you.
I'm not even sure that's quite right. I mean, it may be that we can find so some aspect of the whole community to which we can apply it. For example, suppose that we were interested in knowing what would happen if all of humanity found itself in a rather tricky position in some very strong gravitational field in which quantum theory would seem to be an essential tool to be applying to understand what's going to happen next. That might be something one could make sense of on this view. It would be looking at an aspect of humanity and saying, well, we can have that. But again, you're getting me to speculate a bit, which is healthy.
John?
Yeah.
So, Joe.
The issue about the early universe or and leveraging things, I mean, even if you don't go back to the early universe, if you just go back to times before there were any human beings, mm-hmm. you talk about the possibility of sort of leveraging descriptions right. to talk about some kind of narrative back then. But it seems that even if you can manage to do that, the nature of that narrative mm-hmm. is going to be different than the nature of the narrative you would mm-hmm. talk about things going on now, where there are observers making experiments and so on. And yet, the narratives would be in many ways talking about what, from a naive view at least, we would call the same physics. Right. So having qualitatively different types of narratives about what we're at least led to think about it as the same kind of physics seems a bit disturbing, doesn't it?
I'm not sure that I'm forced to that conclusion. I mean, we're not going back to the early universe, but just going back to, say, 2 billion years ago, something like that. We're still on Earth, and it's sort of a messy place, and there weren't any humans.
Well, let's go before the solar system or something like that, before.
That might be a little bit too far.
Well,
it's something that we...
I mean, things are pretty banal, then. I mean, there's nothing...
Going back to a situation where if very possibly there had been a human around, that human would have had access to the sorts of things that human could have recognized as microscopic objects. That's the kind of scenario in which I'm happy thinking of quantum mechanics as having an application for us. We can say, well, let's suppose that was the wave function we want to ascribe to things just before some quantum system interacted with some macroscopic object that there was back then. Then what would the probabilities be? And that might be an interesting question for us to ask. And it's not ruled out of court by anything I've said.
I don't quite see what the nature of that narrative would be, or how you would connect it with experiments one could do today that would look back to that time.
I don't see any difference in this respect between the scenario we were just considering and the 19th century. They're both in the past. They both contain microscopic objects and quantum systems interacting with them in various ways. In both cases, we want to start ascribing quantum states to quantum systems and entertaining ourselves by calculating quantum probabilities for various outcomes of measurement-like processes. Things get fuzzy when there was just nothing that even vaguely resembled a microscopic object. There, the story has to be different. But I'm not sure I have to be too embarrassed by that. If I can, as you put it, leverage descriptive talk such that it's still applicable, but in a very sort of tentative, hands-offy sort of way, then I can say things using that descriptive talk about what happened in the early universe. And that might make me feel better. It might make me think I understood something. Or captured part of what was to be captured by Bell's great enterprise. And it may also be that we just have to face it and say, well, this is quantum mechanics. It's not our last word. It's where we are today. And maybe 11 years from now, Bell's distant descendant will be happy. Good action. But we don't have to go that way.
This is sort of a follow-up on my previous. That argument you had about classical physics, of us not being able to have a usable, complete model of our universe. It seems to me that doesn't quite get to the heart of addressing Bell's worries, because what Bell is saying is, look, textbook quantum mechanics has, as part of the very formulation, things like observer and apparatus and measurement. And it looks like that's essential to even formulate the theory. And classical mechanics doesn't have that.
Right.
And that still seems to be true, even if all of this is true. And it's true that we have to have observers in order to have a model of our universe, even in classical mechanics, because we have to be there and we have to use them. Actually, let me just go back a little bit more. So it seems to me that from your point of view, you ought to be able to accept them. But yes, there is that difference between classical mechanics and quantum mechanics, because Bell is saying, well, my worry about formulating quantum mechanics in terms of observer and apparatus and stuff like that is those are words that don't belong in a descriptive
right.
fundamental physical theory, and that is a difference, it seems to me, from your point of view, that classical mechanics can be thought of in this sense as a descriptive fundamental theory, if it's not the right one for our world, whereas quantum mechanics, you don't want to think of it that way.
Right.
So it seems to me that you don't have to have this slide. and because they're really, even on your point of view, there is, in that sense, a real difference between quantum and classical.
That's
classical
true.
Could be taken as a fundamental physical theory whose formulation doesn't require words like apparatus and observer and stuff like that, even if use of it requires opening
right.
the observer in the model.
But what I'm trying to say is that that's true, but it's not nearly as important as he thinks of it. And the point about what this argument was supposed to do was to point out a parallel between quantum theory and classical theory. Now, you pointed out a disanalogy, but this is an analogy, so I think that it's important to come back with the analogy in case people get so caught up with the disanalogy. And I think that Bell wants to take this to be a disanalogy, and I'm trying to argue that that doesn't work.
Keep everyone here too long. But this is a follow-up again, I suppose, to my one. So if you don't want there to be a causal explanation, why go so far? Because now you don't really care about Bell's theory. Bell's theory says, well, if you have special relativistic causal structure and you care about the principle of quantum cause, then you have this contradiction with quantum mechanics. Now, if you say, oh, I don't care about the principle of quantum cause anymore, why, like Fine said, why the correlations need an explanation?
Right.
I don't care about that anymore.
Right.
If you get rid of that, then you can talk about things happening in space-time and have some kind of, presumably you could extend quantum mechanics to have some kind of description where there are events happening, and you just have a probability distribution over events happening in regions. A bit like, I don't know, Adrian Kent's Pincher, he has a theory like that, or something like the Gahoan history, if they've sorted that out.
I don't know Adrian Kent, so I'd like to learn about that. But you're right. I mean, I'm not nearly so upset by Bell's theorem as those people are who go around scratching their heads to say, oh no, you have to have a causal explanation. It can't be common cause. It must be some kind of space-like causation, but it's symmetric, so how could it be? That seems to be the wrong way to go.
But if you don't have that causal explanation, why do you need to still talk about measurements? Can't you say, well, I'm at liberty to get rid of all this talk of measurements now. Just talk about things happening. And because if you don't care about Bell's theorem now, you can still have a description of the world which was just some probability distribution over some kind of configurations of things. And that wouldn't contradict Bell's theorem. You just have correlations between space-like things which provide no explanation. So you don't need any subjective talk anymore.
Yeah, I don't think that I'm introducing what you call the subjective talk. I hope it's not. But in order to get around Bell's theorem, that's not the purpose. I mean, once we've already got this framework established, from the perspective, somebody might take the perspective that other people have, that the fundamental problem in quantum mechanics is the measurement problem. So you could think of what I'm doing is attacking that problem. And then Bill's work on non-locality just has to be sort of absorbed within the context of a theory that's already set out to attack the measurement problem, or an idea is a problem, or something like that. So that's not the goal. And I'm not tailoring the account to handle non-locality in the way that you seem to be suggesting I was. But there's going to be a story about it, and I think the story will be that certainly you don't have to accept there is non-locality in a sense of causal non-locality. And what we do end up saying is going to be sort of interesting. I mean, part of it is going to be involve this new perspective on the quantum states. Well, not new. This perspective on the quantum states came quite old, actually. According to which the quantum state is not something that collapses in such a way as to produce strange events at unspecified space-time locations over at Bob when Alice does something over here. So what Alice and what Bob do to their own quantum states in this situation is going to be the relevant question to ask. And this is going to be one situation in which they are physically situated in such circumstances that probably they will be well advised to use different quantum states at different times. And again, when I talk about different times, you can relativize that. So, each of their world ones, I guess. And please, if you think that there are objections, you won't adequately answer. Hammer me for the next few days, because I'm trying to collect objections. See whether I change anything. I know I fixed the thing.